All right, the next case in front of the court is State of South Dakota versus Ariana Reese. We have Mark Cady appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant, Ms. Reese, and Aaron Hanke appearing on behalf of the Attorney General's office. I would note we've got a related case that were actually consolidated for trial purposes that will be argued separately right after this. We won't take a break once we conclude the argument in this case. Mr. Cady, you'll have 15 minutes initially for your argument, and then Ms. Hanke, you'll have 15 minutes and then a 5-minute rebuttal at that time. Mr. Cady, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. This is a case of two versions of the same event. In one version, the defendant was sexually assaulted and escaped from the alleged victim with the help of the co-defendant. In the other, the defendants attacked and took the complaining witness's wallet and debit card from him. Which version was the jury to believe? In this case, evidence that was excluded and also evidence that was admitted adversely affected the jury's decision. The excluded evidence comes in the form of the immigration status of the alleged victim, Mr. Rojas, as an undocumented alien. Rojas, we maintain, had an interest to lie. He was trying to avoid arrest for rape that leads to deportation proceedings, and U visas approved by law enforcement can provide a remedy if the witness cooperates in the case. Now, the admitted evidence in the form of the bank records of Mr. Rojas were used to show that Reese was not acting like a victim. Now, each error standing alone is sufficiently prejudicial. Standing together, more so. Thus, and they both are warranting a new trial. Now, the defendant went into this fight with one arm tied behind her back. Now, in a battle with a two-armed opponent, one arm is not enough. One arm can block one punch from the two-armed opponent, but it can do nothing against the second punch that gets through such limited defenses. Now, the Delaware versus Fernster rule is frequently mentioned in a case like this involving confrontation. And that rule states the confrontation clause guarantees an opportunity for effective cross-examination and not cross-examination that is effective in whatever way and to whatever extent the defense might wish.
So, Mr. Cady, in this case, is the rule that you advocate a categorical rule that would, in all instances, provide for the admissibility of the U visa impeachment evidence, or would that be a determination that the trial court would make in the first instance?
I'm not advocating for something that I would be an over-inclusive interpretation of what I'm asking for. I'm asking for actually something quite narrow. As I said, the Fernster rule states what it says, but it's not the only rule. And it is subject to exceptions that become more powerful the more specific the topic of confrontation becomes. And citing Delaware Van Ardsel, we look at a violation is stated by showing that the defendant is prohibited from engaging in otherwise appropriate cross-examination designed to show a prototypical form of bias on the part of the witness. And in answer to your question more specifically, when we think of confrontation and cross-examination, a set of questions dealing with general attacks on credibility come to mind. But is within that set of questions is a smaller, much smaller subset of questions dealing with particular attacks on bias and motive to lie. And within that subset, there is an even smaller subset of situations where bias and motive to lie questions are completely excluded. And I'd argue that's what we have here. When we narrow it down, there's a very specific set of facts in this case that do not threaten the Fernster rule at all.
So there was an absence of It was absence of all bias or motive to lie cross-examination?
Motive to lie concerning...
just the U visas.
Well, immigration status leading to a need for a U visa. Because we're in a situation where someone is undocumented. They're at risk for being picked up and deported for any offense. Any contact with police conceivably could lead to that. And here we have definite contact with police. And we have an alternate allegation going the other way that Ms. Reese testified about being sexually assaulted.
Now, is the timing relevant here, counsel, with reference to the alleged victim approaching counsel and obtaining knowledge of the U visa?
I think because the immigration status of being undocumented is present all the time, it affects what information he gave at the time of the initial investigation, and it follows through to the time when he is checking into things, because he's concerned. He is concerned that this case might, quote, hurt, unquote, him. So that is persisting throughout the whole thing. And if there was a meeting with the prosecutor the Friday before the Wednesday trial, where these matters were brought up. And then you have a continuing interest. And I'll go into specifics of that because I think it's really important to know what exactly was stated. Because the trial court insinuated there was no agreement. I think these passages that I'm about to read to you show that there was a meeting of the minds. At volume 3 of the transcripts, page 151, the prosecutor states that he, meaning Rosehoff, mentioned the visa program to the prosecutor the Friday before the Wednesday meeting, Wednesday trial. And at volume 3, page 144, Rosehoff testifies that the state's attorney said, eventually you can apply for a visa, a U visa. So not only is the interest present through from the beginning to the end, it's growing. It's growing during that meeting, and then the Wednesday trial is there, and he testifies there as well. He testifies before the court. He's not allowed to testify about that subject during the trial. But that visa is conditioned on him cooperating. By the time of the trial, he knows that, because all this stuff was discussed at a pretrial hearing when he's there. And so it's his knowledge of the issues. He knows that he's illegal. He knows that he's illegally present without proper documentation. He knows that he could be arrested at any time. He has read his rights because of his status of being of vulnerability. So he's aware that there are risks with all of this. And the way through is the U visa that requires the prosecutor to sign off on it. And that prosecutor says to him, eventually you can apply for a visa. Not right now. Not before the trial. After. Sometime afterward. And so there are some cases that talk about the timing of when the interest is. I think you have to see, look at the probability, as shown in this case, that the interest can still be there over time. And it can manifest itself in different ways. And so I submit that that's an agreement. But even if it wasn't an agreement, Davis, Van Artsel, and State versus Wounded Head, one of our cases, 305 Northwest 2nd at 677, says a possible motive, a possible interest is what all you need. It's what you might need. Might is also suggests a broader set of circumstances can fit under it.
Let me ask this, if I could, sort of a similar question. Can you envision, I understand your position here, and I understand the relief that you're requesting. Can you envision an instance where this sort of information is not allowed as impeachment evidence? Well, could it happen that way?
Well, Your Honor,
potentially?
Well, in terms of potentially, it's difficult to say that because I don't know what that case in the future is. I just know about this one right here, and I know about the rules that have preceded it. And so we are specifically asking about, we're raising constitutional specifically, complete defense, and right to confront a witness. And I would think that this concern in a case like this, confronting a witness and not being allowed to do it, having evidence excluded, is probably more dangerous than where evidence is erroneously admitted. Because at least the court's in a position to compare it to other things that are admitted and to see whether or not it had any effect. You know, a hearsay statement that someone saw a murder comes in, but five other witnesses were there that saw it and they all testified. Not that big of a deal. But here, you don't know. It's more difficult to determine what the value of that would have had on the jury's perception of the witness. Not necessarily on the end result of the case, the jury's perception of the witness, because they didn't get to see it. So that's what makes this more of a concern. So it depends on the context of what is that future case. Is it coming in as here? What is the rule that is being broken by getting into that? And I don't know what that is at this point. I just know about this.
That's kind of what I'm driving at. You know, we'll, in the course of determining your arguments in this case and the next one, we may well have a decision that states a rule for use not only in these cases but in continuing cases. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I was interested in your thoughts.
Well, it's difficult for me to protect all the future cases, and so I don't have an answer for that. I just know the rules that we've got, and the concern I would have is the issues that are raised here don't necessarily go away if this court issues a rule. Because if this court issues a rule that contravenes Huber and Crane versus Kentucky regarding the complete defense, or Van Arsdell regarding confrontation, I still have to raise that in subsequent cases, if it's pertinent. It doesn't change those rules. And I'm specifically bringing those up. I didn't just bring up relevancy. I didn't just bring up things of that nature. There's another component to this that runs parallel to it, but it's also superior to it, with all due respect.
Mr. Cady, in terms of testing the complaining witnesses' bias or motive in the case, was he aware? Your client testified in her case that he had attempted to sexually assault her. Was he aware that she was going to claim that before she testified in the trial?
Your Honor, I was.
Do you know?
I was not. I think I wasn't there. I wasn't the trial attorney.
Yeah.
But what I seem to recall from the initial pages of the transcript when people were talking about the issue of motives lie through immigration status, I'm pretty sure that Ms. Thomas said something to the effect of what their defense was going to be. I'm pretty sure. I just can't cite you to a page off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure in the beginning of those discussions there was something about what the defense was going to be. But if there's any kind of discussion between Ms. Thomas and the prosecutor and Mr. Rojas apart from that, I don't know.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, with regards to presenting a complete defense, it's interesting to note that the trial court below found some relevance existed regarding the immigration status. And you know that from transcript 3, page 150.
You have 2 minutes, Mr. Cady.
Thank you, Your Honor. This relevance was found through the trial court statements, and the appellee appears to acknowledge that in the brief. If that happens, there's no reason to use Rule 403, which is what has happened here, because if it wasn't relevant, there would be no probative value to balance anything against. So that's another indication of how relevant it was. And the appellee did not file a notice of review to challenge that determination about relevance. So I would submit to you that in this case, as opposed to other cases that may have been cited in briefs, the court found it was relevant. It wasn't challenged by the appellee on appeal. So the law of the case says it is relevant. So for this case, it is relevant. And that's where you plug that into the complete defense aspects of Crane versus Kentucky and Huber. A person is entitled to present their theory of the case if it has some foundation in evidence, and however tenuous it is. So that's how low the threshold is for the Constitution. And we have a finding that it's relevant. And so when you keep us from talking about that, the trial court keeps the litigants from talking about that, it denies their ability to present a complete defense. And in light of the time remaining, I just refer the court to other arguments that I've made in my brief. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hanke, you may proceed. You have 15 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. Ariana Reese befriended Julio Gomez Rojas only to take advantage of his generosity. Gomez Rojas gave Reese money, but it wasn't enough. So she, along with her co-defendant Kevin Dickerson, robbed Gomez Rojas. They broke into his apartment, pointed a gun at him, and demanded money. They took his wallet and left Gomez Rojas bloody and bruised. Now, defendant raises two issues on appeal, whether the trial court erred in limiting cross-examination of Gomez Rojas's immigration status, and whether the trial court erred in allowing Gomez Rojas's bank records to be admitted into evidence. But the evidence in this case is overwhelming, and her convictions should be affirmed. Now, from the state's perspective, this is not a he said, she said case, as defense counsel is presenting. True, there are two versions of the events. However, for Mr. Gomez Rojas, there was additional evidence presented outside of just his testimony that would support his version of the events.
Isn't that how it was argued to the jury, that this really came down to his version versus her version?
There was, again, two versions presented. However, Gomez Rojas's version of events had corroborating evidence that Reese's version did not have. So for me, it's not just he said, she said, and who do we believe.
So maybe you could focus on that a little bit more. We have corroborating evidence, certainly, that puts them in the apartment.
Correct.
And maybe under circumstances suggesting they may have been going in there for not a lawful purpose, perhaps. But as to what actually happened inside the apartment, what is the corroborating evidence?
Gomez Rojas testified that he cried out for help. His neighbors heard him crying out for help. Reese testified that she also screamed for help, but the neighbors did not hear her screaming for help. So that corroborates. In addition, Gomez Rojas was pretty bloodied and bruised when law enforcement found him, and he had a large wound on his forehead that was consistent of being hit in the head with a gun. So there was evidence that corroborated what he testified happened to at trial, or in that apartment.
Ms. Hanke, if a similar question to the one I asked Mr. Cady, is it your view that this U visa information was properly excluded here, and that the rule that results from this case should state in some way that that's the way it should always go? This really should never be included. Or is it a more fact-intensive inquiry? And if so, what kind of a test should we have to determine whether this information should come in or not come in? So I'll break it down. Is it a categorical rule or not? And if it's not, what do you think about a test?
I don't think we can have a hard and fast rule, this evidence always comes in or this evidence never comes in. I think it really has to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. And I do think the trial court was right here in doing first the relevancy analysis and then also the 403 analysis in whether or not this information is more probative than prejudice.
There are differences, and I'll acknowledge this, but I'd like your thoughts. What's the difference between a victim or witness who testifies, who has an incentive to not tell the truth in a case such as this versus somebody who is a co-conspirator, let's say in a federal drug prosecution where there's the prospect of the person who's testifying having a reduced sentence by virtue of their cooperation. So their cooperation will lead to a potentially to a diminished sentence. How do they differ?
Well, in this, so talking about this case specifically, Your Honor.
What kind of compare them and contrast them?
Okay. So in this case specifically, there has been no promises made to our victim. He cooperated on his own volition. I think it's important to note he is the one who initially called law enforcement after he was attacked, or his neighbor called on his behalf. But he reached out to law enforcement to get help. Now, in the situation you're talking about with a co-conspirator, they're already in trouble. They're looking to kind of save their own skin in this matter, so to speak, and they're looking for a way to get that reduction or whatever other benefits that may be. But here, he wasn't reaching out to law enforcement thinking, hey, I'm going to get this U visa, I'm going to help my status. He reached out to law enforcement because he was hurt and he needed help.
Counsel, I could see how that would be a good argument to make in response to this type of evidence coming in. But does that really go to the relevance question of still whether there isn't another side to that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you repeat that question?
The argument that you just made was that he reached out, or at least agreed when the neighbors asked if they should call 911. And so those are arguments to be made as to why he may not have truly had an incentive otherwise to make up a story. But does that, Mr. Katie was referring to the low relevance threshold as to whether there could have been another possible motive here. So does the fact that there is another argument on the other side of that mean that there's no relevance then to the other version of his contacts?
I wouldn't say there's no relevance, and I don't believe the court found there wasn't relevance. What the trial court said was it was limited in its relevancy, and then she moved on to the 403 analysis of whether or not it was more prejudicial than probative.
And why do you think that determination is supported here, the rule 403?
That it was more prejudicial?
Yes.
I think the court found that way because it was prejudicial. As soon as you hear someone is undocumented, that automatically trips something in the juror's mind. And for what value to prove he had a motive or bias to lie? They presented a motive or bias to lie with the alleged rape. So to say that he wasn't able to cross-examine or expose any motive or bias, the defendant was allowed to do that.
This is a disproportionate test for this balancing, right? Once it's not just balancing it straight up, probative force versus the danger of unfair prejudice. The danger of unfair prejudice has to substantially outweigh the probative force, has to be bigger.
Correct.
In its magnitude. Similar to Justice Devaney's question, what tells us and what suggests to us here that was within the court's discretion and didn't divert from constitutional principles, which we would otherwise review de novo in terms of confrontation rights?
In terms of the judge's ruling?
Yes, on the balancing.
She did do the balancing test. And I think at the end of the day, when you look at this case, the defendant was not prejudiced by the exclusion of this evidence. To be prejudiced by the exclusion of this evidence, the evidence would have had to have changed the jury's mind. And I don't think that admitting such evidence would have changed the jury's mind.
Right, that's not balancing, but okay. Let me ask you this question. Is it necessary that to test a witness's purported bias that the immigration status would necessarily have to be revealed? Would it be enough to sort of say, Mr. Rojas, you Is it true you have some sort of a immigration status? You weren't born in the country. You have some sort of immigration status? Yes. Isn't it true that if you cooperate here today, your status can be enhanced or improved? That may not be satisfying to the defense, but could that have happened?
It certainly could have, but that's not going back to saying, that's not saying that what the trial court did here was erroneous.
Ms. Hange, before you run out of time, as to the second issue with regard to the bank records, is the state conceding that the exceptions to the hearsay rule for business record admission were not met?
The state recognizes that for proper business record exception to apply, a custodian of the record does need to testify, and here Mr. Gomez Rojas testified to the contents of those bank records.
And so in your tell me about why, if that was an error in your view, it would not have been harmless.
So it was,
or excuse me, that it was harmless.
So it was harmless because it was just a small piece of evidence that was used to corroborate Gomez Rojas's testimony. Or not corroborate, excuse me. It was cumulative to his testimony. So he testified, Dickerson came in with his gun, pointed at him, demanded money, took his wallet, and when Dickerson and Reese left, his wallet was no longer there. And so then he froze his bank account, and he got notified that there were attempted transactions on that bank account. So those bank records are just cumulative to his testimony that there were attempted transactions on that account.
But how he couldn't testify as to all of these additional transactions that he had no knowledge of, could he?
The bank did notify him that there were attempted transactions on his account, which is what prompted him to go with law enforcement to obtain those records.
But again, that would be hearsay from the bank.
Correct. I also think it's important to note, Your Honor, that the crimes that Reese was charged with were burglary and robbery. And so robbery, the intentional taking of property of another, no matter the value. So that happened, the robbery happened once they took the wallet from Gomez Rojas. It doesn't matter what they did with the wallet after they took it from him. So to say that they used the bank card or attempted these transactions didn't really go to the elements of the crimes that were charged.
Well, and the record itself didn't tell us who used the
Correct. There was no, I do not believe there was any testimony or anything as to who actually attempted those transactions, Your Honor.
So was the prosecutor wrong when the prosecutor said, this is a big piece of evidence?
I don't think it was a big piece of evidence in this case.
The prosecutor was wrong? Shouldn't have made that argument?
I am not going to second guess what the state argued down below, Your Honor. However, it was used not to prove, in closing testimony, the evidence was used not to prove guilt, but to negate Reese's defense of the alleged rape.
I want to go back to harmless error on the first issue, the immigration issue. I didn't see that you argued that, assuming the court erred in disallowing that evidence, that it was not prejudicial. Are you arguing that it was not prejudicial if it was error, or are you asserting it was? Either way,
I'm asserting, Your Honor, that it was, the court did not err in disallowing this evidence. I think the court...
Right, but I didn't see you argue whether it was prejudicial.
Correct. I think if there was any error, it was not prejudicial error. It would have been harmless error if there was any error.
And how, what do you base that on?
For a defendant to be prejudiced by the exclusion of evidence, it would have had to have changed the outcome or changed the view of the jury. And here the evidence is just overwhelming into both defendants' guilt here. And so whether or not the immigration status came in, I don't think that would have changed the jury's view of the case or outcome of the case. So if there are no further questions, the state would respectfully request the court to affirm the circuit court.
Thank you. Mr. Cady, you have 5 minutes.
I tried to clean up a few things here. Justice Jensen, you asked me about would Mr. Rojas have known about the rape allegation. On page 10 of volume, trial transcript volume 1, Ms. Thomas indicates that there was going to be a rape allegation. I don't know if he was in the room, but the prosecutor certainly was, and he could have relayed that. I'm a partisan in this case, obviously. I submit, because Mr. Rojas was in the room in his apartment, that he knows about the rape. But I am partisan. There were 3 issues on appeal, not just 2. One was a state law rule 403 issue. That's the 3rd one I listed in my brief. The first 2 dealt with constitutional issues about the right to present a complete defense and the right to confront witnesses. And on the first 2 listed in my brief, I would ask you to apply de novo review because they're constitutional claims. And I've heard terms about harmless error being mentioned. I hear about changing the jury's mind, changing the result of the case. With regards to the Confrontation Clause issue, the focus should be on the effect of the juror's perception of the witness, not the end result. That's right out of Van Arsdale. With regards to harmless error, because there are constitutional issues being raised here, that if a constitutional violation is found, this court should imply the Chapman harmless error test, meaning it must be shown to be harmless error behind any reasonable doubt. The standards between harmless error and the substance and difference between harmless error and harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt is huge. Harmless error just deals with questions of state law. In all probability, that it changed the verdict. So it's just a probable standard. Preponderance, perhaps, is a better way to describe that. But beyond any reasonable doubt, is so much bigger. That's a substantive difference that this court will be depriving my client of if it uses harmless error to decide this case instead of harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, with regards to the rape allegation being enough, isn't that just enough? No, it isn't. And the reasons for that are, you know, I cited the Carrero-Vargas case, and it talked about material reasons to lie. We're not limited to just one. Reasons to lie, a reason to lie is like the shoes on your feet. You can get farther with 2 than you can with 1. And you never know if you didn't do enough until you see the guilty verdict come in. That's when you know, maybe I should have tried a little more or put on a little more. And we had something to put on. And we weren't able to do that. The jury never had the benefit of considering Mr. Rojas' expectations with regards to U visas and things like that. And with regards to the timing of the interests generating the motive of the lie, once you state to police that you're a victim of the crime and you weren't, and then trial comes along, you still have an interest to maintain that story, because then the false report charge can come, or the perjury charge can come. It's something that covers this whole case. He had an interest before the trial, he had an interest during the trial, and he had an interest after the trial.
Mr. Cady, I'm taking just a couple seconds.
Sure.
I know you're winding down, but I want to get your thoughts on this. You do this. I don't. Is it possible that there could have been cross-examination without really revealing wholesale the legal immigration status in this case? And in any event, would that have been satisfying?
I'm not I am not sure, because you have to explain how the status generates certain concerns that need to be acted upon. I don't know. I don't, right now with 20 seconds to go, Your Honor, I don't got it. All right. You know, if you want further briefing, I'll be happy to look into that, but I don't have an answer for that now. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Caney.